Bonjour mesdames et messieurs, merci d'avoir patienté. Bienvenue à l'appel conférence du 4e trimestre 2011 de SNC-Lavalin. Présentement, toutes les lignes sont en écoute seulement. Suivant la présentation, il y aura une période de questions et réponses. Les directives reliées à cette période seront données en ce moment. Si vous avez des difficultés pendant la conférence, veuillez s'il vous plaît appuyer sur l'étoile, suivre du zéro pour l'assistance d'un ou d'une téléphoniste. De plus, veuillez noter que cet appel est enregistré. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to the SNC-Lavalin Q4 2011 conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Following the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session with instructions provided. If anyone has any difficulties in your conference, please press star zero for operator assistance at any time. I would like to remind everyone that this conference call is being recorded today, Monday, March 26, 2012, at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'll now turn the conference over to Dennis Jasmine, Vice President of Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to SNC-Lavalin's fourth quarter 2011 conference call. With us today are Gwynne Morgan, Chairman of the Board of Directors, Yin Bourne, Vice Chairman and Interim Chief Executive Officer, Gilles Laramé, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, and Leslie Quentin, Vice President, Global Corporate Communications. We will discuss today the two press releases that were issued this morning. Please note that we have posted a slide presentation on our website, which we will refer to during our call. Before we begin, I would like to remind listeners that, as detailed on slide 3, certain statements or comments made during today's call and slide presentation may be forward-looking. Such statements or comments represent management's best judgment and expectation as of today's date, are subject to certain risks or uncertainties and assumptions, which are described on slide number 3 and cannot be guaranteed. I would now like to turn the conference over to our chairman, Gwynne Morgan.
Well, thank you, Denise, and good morning. Given the recent announcement and changes to the company's leadership, I'll be leading the call today as chair of the board. Pierre Duhem has stepped down from his position as Chief Executive Officer and as a director and will retire from the company. Pierre has made major contributions to the growth and profitability of the company during his 23 years of dedicated service. The board has accepted his decision to step down, and we wish him well in the future. I will be immediately commencing a search for a new CEO with consideration of both internal and external candidates. At the request of other members of the board, Ian Bourne has agreed to assume the function of Vice Chairman and Interim Chief Executive Officer of the company. Ian is a seasoned executive who served as a senior officer of a number of Canadian public corporations and is well-versed in the affairs of the company, having served as a director on the audit, and Health, Safety, and Environment Committee since 2009. The board has struck a special transition committee composed of Ian as the interim CEO together with the chairman of the Audit and the Human Resources Committees, David Goldman and Larry Stevenson, and myself, to assist with transitional matters, including as a resource to the management team. As you know from our February 26 press release, your board of directors commissioned an independent review of the facts and circumstances surrounding the certain payments and contracts that were documented to projects to which they did not relate. We also said we were taking steps to implement changes and to take any other appropriate actions arising from the findings of that review. The Audit Committee directed and provided oversight for the independent review, which was carried out by our external independent counsel with the assistance of investigative advisors to provide business intelligence and related services. A summary of the Audit Committee's independent review can be found on our filings this morning. Since it has been much speculated in media reports, I want to note that, based upon the review's findings, we do not believe that these payments related to Libya. The independent review's findings include that payments were apparently intended for the retention of agents on projects within the construction division. However, no direct conclusive evidence has been found to determine with certainty the use of the payments or the nature of the services rendered under the arrangements. The board has adopted the independent review recommendations, which are directed primarily at reinforcing standards of conduct, strengthening and improving internal controls and processes, and reviewing the compliance environment. We have great confidence in management's capacity to translate the lessons learned into company-wide improvements. There is no question that these events have presented the company and you, our shareholders, with many challenges. But the fundamentals of our business remain strong. Our year-end release shows the company's considerable accomplishments in 2011 that position us well for 2012. Recent large project award announcements and a growing project backlog demonstrate the confidence of our clients. Focused on the future of our company they believe in, our highly capable management team is rallying in support of our interim CEO while we move expeditiously with our search for a new CEO. Our 28,000 employees working on projects in more than 100 countries remain firmly committed to providing our thousands of clients around the world with the high-quality services that have made SNC-Lavalin one of the most respected names in the global engineering and construction sector. I now turn the call over to our interim CEO, and I take the opportunity to thank Ian on behalf of the board for his willingness to step up at this important time for our company.
Thank you, Gwynn. Good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak to you in my role as interim CEO. As Gwynn said, I have been closely involved with SNC-Lavalin for 3 years as a member of the board of directors. I'm committed to leading the company as we implement the changes the board has approved to strengthen our internal processes and procedures. I'm equally committed to making sure that as a company, we are focused on our clients and delivering the very high quality work they expect from us on every project. Jill will talk about the financial performance. However, first I would like to highlight some of the major developments in 2011, starting with slide 4. Last September, we completed the acquisition of Macquarie Essential Assets Partnership's 23% ownership interest in Calgary-based AltaLink for a total consideration of $229 million in cash. As a result of this transaction, SNC-Lavalin now has full ownership of AltaLink. Also in September, the Rainbow Hospital Partnership, wholly owned by SNC-Lavalin, was awarded a public-private partnership contract by the Government of New Brunswick for the design, construction, commissioning, financing, and certain operations and maintenance functions at the new Restigouche Hospital Center for Psychiatric Care in Campbellton, New Brunswick. The partnership subcontracted the construction of the new hospital to an SNC-Lavalin-led joint venture with the operation and maintenance managed by SNC-Lavalin. One of our French subsidiaries entered into an agreement with the French government to upgrade the infrastructure and build a new terminal building for the Mayotte Airport, which is located on an island located in the Indian Ocean. This subsidiary has also the mandate to manage and maintain the airport for a 15-year period, in addition to assuming the commercial development. In a good start to 2012, the 407 East Development Group, 50% owned by SNC-Lavalin, was selected as the preferred bidder to design, build, finance, and maintain Phase 1 of the new Highway 407 East project. Not only is this a nice win for our infrastructure group, but it will also bring more traffic onto the existing Highway 407, of which we are a 17% owner. There are still many concession opportunities worldwide and in Canada especially, and SNC-Lavalin will continue to selectively invest in them. Let's discuss our outlook on slide 5. Over the past 100 years, our company has continued to prosper and to grow an impressive global footprint. Our ability to remain a world leader is due in large part to our comprehensive portfolio of services and products. It is a key factor that has enabled us to sustain our profitability over the years. Canada remained the company's largest revenue source, representing 56% of our 2011 total revenues. Africa remained our second largest market with 16%. We have increased our revenue by 44% in Latin America and 32% in Asia Pacific and Europe. Speaking of Europe, I want to take a moment to thank Jean-Claude Pingat for his many years of dedicated service to SNC-Lavalin. Jean-Claude retired at the beginning of this year after a long and full career. We are pleased to welcome Christian Jacqui as a member of the Office of the President and the new Executive Vice President for Europe. Christian has more than 20 years of international experience in engineering, project management, and corporate leadership particularly in Europe and Asia. In another change to the Office of the President, you may recall that Charles Scheb was appointed Executive Vice President of the Infrastructure and Construction Business Unit and a member of the Office of the President. Some of you had the chance to meet him at our Investor Day last summer. Charles is an excellent leader with almost 30 years of experience in Canada and internationally. We are confident that under his leadership, the Infrastructure and Construction Group will continue to thrive and grow. We continue to complete our projects in North Africa and the Middle East. We are also focused on creating new opportunities with active business development in those targeted areas. Now let's return to Canada. There are many good prospects for infrastructure. This segment of the economy is very active with bids on many large projects, for example, the Evergreen Line in British Columbia and the Ottawa Light Rail Train. Moving to mining and metallurgy, this market remains strong and promising, especially in Canada and South America. We have just been awarded a contract by Vale to provide project management, engineering, procurement, and construction management services for their $2 billion clean atmospheric emissions reduction project in Sudbury, Ontario. Opportunities in iron, gold, nickel, and diamonds continue to grow in northern Quebec as the government's Plan Nord develops further. Potash is also thriving. We have approximately 400 employees working under our hub contract with BHP Billiton, mainly on the Jansen project in Saskatchewan. The Hydrocarbons and Chemicals Group, formerly called Chemicals and Petroleum, is also pursuing many opportunities. The group has recently signed a new contract with PDVSA for the project in Venezuela, which we recently announced. Working closely with the client, our project management team will supervise the work of contractors who will provide engineering, procurement, construction, installation, and commissioning services for the offshore and onshore facilities. Andy McIntosh's team is looking at prospects around the world. The power market remains strong. On the nuclear power front, in October 2011, CANDU Energy Inc., a wholly owned subsidiary of the company, acquired certain assets of Atomic Energy of Canada Limited's commercial reactor division. And recently, SNC-Lavalin, in joint venture with its partner, has been awarded a major contract by Ontario Power Generation to carry out the definition phase for the Darlington retube and feeder replacement project. The overall project consists of two phases, a definition phase from 2012 to 2016 and an execution phase from 2016 to 2023. Patrick Lamar and his team also continue to look at new nuclear build opportunities domestically and internationally. In hydro, we are fully engaged in the Lower Churchill EPCM and are looking at opportunities in Africa and India. And lastly, on the transmission and distribution side, we are currently exploring possibilities in Africa and Canada. We are particularly pleased that the government of Alberta is proceeding with the development of the Western Alberta Transmission Line project. In our operations and maintenance group, Charlie Raitt has an extensive portfolio of business and is actively pursuing new opportunities. Our remote camp operations and maintenance support capabilities extend to mining and petroleum projects, and as this latter sector recovers, we can expect more bids in this field. Finally, our infrastructure concession investments group remains an important source of predictable earnings for the company. The emphasis on P3s will create new opportunities in Canada and around the world. And of course, Gilles Laramie has been a driving force in the success of this segment. We expect full year 2012 net income to be in line with reported 2011 results. This is based on our backlog, particularly in the power and mining and metallurgy segments, as well as the infrastructure concession investments segment. The hydrocarbons and chemicals and infrastructure and environment segments will continue to be challenged throughout 2012. So what does all this mean in terms of the dividend? Please look at slide 6. The Board of Directors has increased the quarterly cash dividend by 5% to 22 cents a share. This extends our recent track record of annual increases, which reflects our sustained performance. Before concluding, I want to note that both the Bangladesh investigation and the proposed class action suit are ongoing and are covered in the written materials distributed this morning. In closing, I want to say that I will continue to count on my colleagues on the Board of Directors for their counsel and support, and on all our employees for their continuing hard work and dedication to the future success of the company. I'm eager to start working together. And now, over to Jean.
Thank you, Ian. Good morning, everyone. I would now like to go through the fourth quarter and the year-end financial results. Let's start at slide number 8. Net income for the fourth quarter of 2011 was $76 million, compared to $159 million for the fourth quarter 2010, or $133 million excluding the 2010 net gain of $26 million from the disposal of two infrastructure concession investments. This variance, excluding the 2010 net gain, mainly reflects operating loss in infrastructure and environment and in hydrocarbons and chemicals segments, mainly due to unfavorable cost reforecast on certain projects, a $22 million loss from a revised position of the company net financial position on its Libyan infrastructure projects, and a period expenses of $35 million, which we will be addressed on the next slide. This is partially offset by higher operating income, mainly from the mining and metallurgy and operations and maintenance segments. Now turning to slide number 9. For 2011, net income attributable to SNC-Lavalin shareholders was $379 million, compared to $477 million, or $431 million excluding the net gains of $46 million from the disposal of certain assets and investments recognized in 2010. The variance reflected a 23% decrease in net income excluding ICI, partially offset by a 21% increase from ICI. The decrease in net income excluding ICI mainly reflected a lower contribution from infrastructure and environment, partially offset by higher contributions from all other segments, while the increase in net income from ICI reflected higher dividends from Highway 407. As announced in our February 28 press release, the company recognized a net loss of $35 million related to payments made in the fourth quarter of 2011 under what are presumed to be agency agreements. It should also be noted that the company's 2010 results were adjusted by reducing the net income by $17.9 million to reflect the impact of payments of $20 million in 2010 under what is presumed to be an agency agreement that were charged and documented to construction projects to which they did not relate. The company decided to correct its prior period comparative financial information in its first issuance of annual audited consolidated financial statements prepared in accordance with IFRS. Now let's turn to slide number 10. Year-to-date revenues increased by 20% in 2011 to $7.2 billion, compared to $6 billion. Revenues increased in all company segments of activities and in all revenue categories, with packages revenues growing by 34% and services revenue growing by 19%. Revenue in Canada increased by 30% in 2011, mainly due to higher level of packages activities. Revenue from outside Canada increased by 10% in 2011. Now turning to slide 11, you can see the list of our main business acquisitions of 2011. We added approximately 2,900 people to our global workforce through the acquisition of certain assets of AECL Commercial Reactor Division and six other acquisitions. At the end of the year, we had about 28,000 employees, which is 4,000 more than in December 2010. Now turning to slide number 12. As expected, the services gross margin amount increased in 2011, primarily reflecting a higher level of activity, notably in mining metallurgy, partially offset by a lower gross margin to revenue ratio, mainly in mining metallurgy and hydrocarbons and chemicals. Also as expected, the gross margin amount for packages decreased in 2011. This was mainly due to a lower gross margin to revenue ratio, mainly in infrastructure and environment and power, partially offset by higher level of activity, notably in power. It's noteworthy to mention that the 20% gross margin to revenue ratio for packages in 2010 was above the company target range of 7 to 10%. The operations and maintenance gross margin amount increased in 2011 compared to the previous year, mainly reflecting a higher gross margin to revenue ratio on certain ongoing contracts. The gross margin amount for ICI increased in 2011 compared to 2010, mainly due to increased gross margin from AltaLink and higher dividend from Highway 407, partially offset by the net gain before tax of $30 million from disposal of Trendcap and Valenair in 2010, and by the absence of contributions in 2011 from these two investments, which were sold in the fourth quarter of 2010. Now, turning to slide number 13. As expected, SG&A expenses increased in 2011, mainly due to approximately $45 million from business recently acquired, as well as a 5% increase in the overall SG&A expenses. Revenues from infrastructure and environment increased in 2011. It should be noted that the revenues in this segment for 2011 included $86 million of revenues from Libya compared to $418 million in 2010. The overall increase in revenues was lower, however, lower than anticipated. The operating income from infrastructure and environment was below expectations, as the increase in 2011 was greater than expected, mainly due to a lower than anticipated gross margin to revenue ratio. This was primarily resulting from unfavorable cost reforecast on certain major packages project in 2011, as well as a fourth quarter loss related to the company's financial position regarding its Libyan infrastructure projects, combined with a lower than anticipated increase in the volume of activity. The 2010 operating income was positively impacted by favorable cost reforecasts on certain major packages projects. It should be noted that the 2010 operating income was unfavorably adjusted to reflect a correction of $20 million under what is presumed to be an agency agreement, as previously explained. The company recorded a $39 million loss in 2011 related to Libyan projects that were in progress before the company evacuated Libya. $22 million of this amount was recognized in the fourth quarter for our net financial position, excluding $23 million of cash held in a Libyan bank, to be nil. This final position was determined with the projects being considered on an aggregated basis. As a result, the deferred revenue and advances from these projects are economically offset by trade receivables and contracts in progress on these same projects. Hydrocarbons and chemicals revenues increased in 2011. The operating income also increased in 2011, but it was below the company's expectations, mainly due to unfavorable cost reforecasts on certain packages project, as well as $35 million of period expenses in the fourth quarter of 2011, as previously explained. In 2010, the low level of operating income was mainly due to unfavorable cost reforecasts on certain packages projects. As expected, mining metallurgy revenue increased in 2011. Also as expected, the operating income increased, reflecting a higher level of activity. The increase was partially offset by a lower gross margin to revenue ratio in services, mainly due to lower gross margins on certain major projects, combined with additional costs on the one project in the first quarter of 2011. As expected, power revenues increased in 2011, mainly reflecting a higher level of packages activity. While we expected the operating income from power to increase, it remained in line, as the higher level of packages activity was offset mainly by a lower gross margin to revenue ratio. 2010 results were favorably impacted by a gain before taxes of $23 million from the disposal of certain technology solution assets, as well as favorable costs reforecast in 2010. Other industries, operating income increased, mainly due to a higher level of activity, partially offset by a lower gross margin to revenue ratio. Operation maintenance operating income increased in 2011, mainly reflecting a higher gross margin to revenue ratio. The company expected the operating income from the ICI segment to remain in line when excluding the 2010 $26 million net gain on disposal of Trendcap and Valenair. It increased, excluding the net gain, mainly due to higher dividends from Highway 47, as well as a higher contribution from AltaLink, partly offset by the absence of contributions in 2011 from the company's investments in these two disposed investments, which were sold in the fourth quarter of 2010. Now turning to the financial position on slide number 15. As you can see, the company's financial position remains solid, with cash totaling $1.2 billion at year-end, and our shareholders' equity stands at $1.9 billion. Slide number 16 presents our cash and cash equivalents for the past 5 years, as well as our return on average shareholders' equity. The company's return on average shareholders' equity is 19% for 2011. Now turning to slide 17. As we can see on this slide, the cash totaled $1.2 billion at the end of 2011, about the same level of 2010, notwithstanding the $864 million of investing activities. This cash was used for investing activities is mainly due to $546 million of acquisition of property and equipment related to AltaLink, acquisition of businesses, and cash invested in ICI. These investing activities were more than offset by $920 million in cash generated from operating activities. Now turning to slide number 18. This slide shows the net book value and the estimated fair value of our ICI. Taking into account the transaction price of the 23% minority interest of AltaLink acquired by SNC Lavalin, following our exercise of our right of first refusal and our offer by a third party, plus the cash injected by SNC Lavalin since the transaction, the estimated market value of our investment in AltaLink is $1 billion. The estimated market value of our 407 investment amounts to $1.5 billion based on the 10% interest acquired by CPPIB in October of 2010. Our other infrastructure concession investment have a net book value of $763 million. When we add the estimated market value of our investment in Highway 47 and AltaLink to the net book value of our other ICI, we arrive to a value of approximately $3.3 billion or $22 per share. Now turning to slide 19. Revenue backlog at year-end went up, reflecting an increase in services, partially offset by a decrease in O&M and packages. Services backlog went up by 58% in 2011, reflecting an increase in all companies in industry segments, with the highest increase in mining metallurgy. Packages backlog decreased in 2011, resulting primarily from a decrease in infrastructure and environment, partially offset by an increase in mining metallurgy and power. The 2011 operation maintenance backlog decreased, reflecting the normal fluctuations in the timing of long-term contracts, primarily in Canada. Now turning to the slide number 20. This slide is meant to show that we continue to provide a solid return on equity compared to our peers, and that our PE multiple for our activities other than ICI now stands at 7.5 times based on a trailing 12 months results. Before I conclude my presentation, let me just take a moment to talk about the material weakness disclosure. The company has identified material weaknesses in its internal control over financial reporting as of December 31st, 2011, relating to management override and non-compliance with and ineffective controls over compliance with the company's policy on commercial agents and its code of ethics. As a result, the company has concluded that the disclosure controls and procedure and its internal control over financial reporting were not effective as of December 31, 2011. These material weaknesses and proposed remedial measures are fully described in the company annual management discussion and analysis. This concludes the presentation. We now open the lines for the question period. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now conduct a question and answer session. If you have a question, please press the star followed by the 1 on your touchtone phone. You'll hear a tone acknowledging your request. If you're using a speakerphone today, please lift the handset before pressing the keys. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, you may press the star followed by the 1. Your first question today comes from Sarah O'Brien with RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Hi. Can you comment, do you expect that the investigation will go forward by the regulatory authorities and possibly a criminal investigation will follow as well?
It's Gwen Morgan here. We have no knowledge of that. I think the there's several issues here. The matter of Libya, we believe, is a separate, completely separate issue with regard than the payments, as we've said already. There is, as you know, we're actually learning more from what the media says than what we can find internally, because we don't have the people with us anymore that were involved. But I think the big thing is that the big thing for us is to just turn over whatever we have and whatever we've learned to the authorities, which is what we're doing, and we have no idea where they're going to take that, but we'll cooperate in every possible way. The other matters, I really can't speculate. The report of the independent report to the audit committee speaks for itself.
Okay, and maybe can you comment, if it's not related to Libya, where were these construction projects that these consultants were purportedly related to located, and are you convinced now that there is no more such agency agreements in SNC's history or current practice?
First part of the question, for commercial reasons and because of client confidentiality, neither SNC-Lavalin or any other engineering company, to our knowledge, makes available identifies agents or projects associated with those agents. So that is a practice that we can't violate for those reasons. On the basis of these two contracts were unique in a number of different ways, as has already been set out in the different ways they were identified. They weren't charged to contracts that didn't exist. The procedures weren't followed, and so on. The review focused on these particular situations, but on the basis of the review in whole and our internal and external audits, which were extremely thorough, obviously, given the circumstances, no other agency agreement came to light in the context of the independent review and as being improperly documented in respect to the project, which they do not effectively relate, and the board believes that we have identified all the material matters associated with these matters.
Okay, great. And maybe just, Gilles, on the guidance for 2012, can you, I'm assuming it's about $2.49, just wondering, can you break down between ICI and engineering construction, and can you tell us why the guidance is so low given the backlog growth year over year? Is it that you're already seeing booked losses in Q1 for project reforecasts, and maybe a bit of commentary around that?
On the guidance, Sarah, on the basis that we wanted to provide a total guidance without the split of excluding ICI and ICI, and certainly to your comment about being low, as you can see with major events we've been undergoing and also changes at the office of the president, we certainly put a guidance that, we felt good with, so I think I could not say more, but
certainly our backlog position on services is very good, and we're pleased with that. And the first quarter up to now, as mentioned by Ian, there were some good signing of projects. But that being said, I think the guidance, and you will notice that they're in our MD&A, we used to provide quite a bit of guidance. This time around, we restricted to our press release providing overall guidance and really focusing on, for example, the three segments that we believe will be the basis for our results with solid backlog in 2012.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'll turn it over now.
Your next question comes from Anthony Zika with Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. With reference to the cost overruns and reforecast for infrastructure and environment, chemical and petroleum, when are those projects to be completed, and could you give us an idea of what their size is?
They are major projects. They are projects, for example, that are midway. Some, for example, in chemical and hydrocarbons and chemicals that have started, and you know, with certainly being difficult from the start. And there's a mixed bag of those projects. Some that are closer to be completed. So as any other quarters, as you well know, there is positive impact, and certainly we have more tendency to focus on the unfavorable projects. Still, on the overall margin for the full year, when you're looking at packages, we our gross margin to revenue ratio is set at 10%, which is certainly within the range of our 7 to 10% gross margin ratio on revenue for packages. But for sure, there have been someone that on infrastructure and environment and hydrocarbons and chemical in the last quarter that got us to take certain additional loss.
And Jill, could there be some spillover in Q1 from those projects?
Again, there cannot be any guarantee, Anthony. Certainly, we went thoroughly in looking at our contract, but for sure, there cannot be guarantee about that. And we've been trying in the past to look and review carefully, and the project manager also taking the necessary contingency and risk. However, that being said, it's part of our business. There will be positive and negative on execution of contract, and that is the nature of our business. But as you have seen over the last years, our track record of, let's say, has been pretty good.
And one more question. Relating to the packages, which international region experienced the most challenging environment, and what has caused the weakness in the margins in these packages?
I would not pinpoint one particular region, if I could say. I think it's it's not necessarily a region. One thing to be said, however, certainly the packages business in the PPP market, as it is very competitive, provides a basis whereby the gross margin to revenue are lower than typical project of that very competitive marketplace, as you well know. But there is no one to be pointing out specifically it's because of a region or another region. No, there's nothing that comes to that.
Jill, just in maybe you could just add to the answer to that question. You've already made the point that our package revenues for 2000, our package margin for 2011 were lower in 2010, partly because 2010 was exceptionally high. What has been the normalized expectation for margins and packages?
Our stated normalized margin, and certainly in line with the basis on which we're bidding those projects, is in the 7 to 10% margin. And certainly in 2010, with 20%, we've seen many projects that were winding down provide very favorable positive inflow, positive income in 2010.
Okay, well, thank you.
Your next question comes from Paul Lechem with CIBC. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Just maybe following on some of those questions on the cost overruns. I mean, you made the comment, Jill, that the P3 market has been very competitive, and you've recently been selected as the preferred proponent for the 407 extension. So, you know, how should we think about the profit potential from that contract? Are you the recent contracts that you've been announcing, are these being signed up at lower go-in margins than historical, or are you comfortable that the margins can trend to your target ranges?
It's a good question, Paul, but as you, we've always refrained from quoting any margin or any profitability on even any given contract, and you could understand here, even more sensitive as we are with a partner. But that being said, in general context, as you know, you're putting a lot of money in bidding those jobs, and the competition is harsh. It's internationally, from an international basis in many instances, and the margin, you need to be very competitive. So certainly there is a downward pressure to have a lower margin than a typical.
So with these projects that have these cost overruns, will they continue to impact your margins until they are complete? How are you recognizing margins on those problem contracts through completion?
There's different type of project. There is project whereby there is only a cost reforecast and the project is still making a profit but lower than was anticipated before. And there is other that we're just losing money upright and we need to record all the loss at the time we know it's known. And in that sense, this influence for sure the margin in the future, as we're not recording any more margin on those, as you know, there were some losses recorded from the beginning. So there's no trend I could mention on that to say in the coming years, because of, you know, we're announcing certain cost reforecasts on certain projects, that will be a trend in 2012. However, that being said, our packages, I'll repeat the word, and for sure, the fourth quarter, we had some cost reforecast, but still, on a 12-month basis, we are 10% on the package side on the margin.
Okay. In 2011, you recorded revenues from Africa of over $1 billion. How much in backlog is still related to North Africa, and what do you expect your revenues to be in Africa, in North Africa, over 2012?
I don't have that piece of information, Paul. It's not something that we have necessarily. We disclose, I would say. We have that in terms of our files, but we don't. I don't have it right now with me.
Is that a region you're looking to exit over time, or at least to de-emphasize over time? Is notionally, should we think that your African business will be ramping down as you complete those contracts?
You know, we have no interest of winding down this region, and certainly, if we, as we mentioned in our MD&A, we're looking at Libya in terms of looking at new opportunities and potentially restarting certain of the projects. And we are working in many countries in Africa, and we have no interest of changing that. And I don't know, Ian.
Yeah, Paul, I would reinforce that. I mean, we are driving forward with the business as we've known it and continue to drive for new opportunities, and we are not backing away from parts of the world in which we have been successful before.
Okay. A couple last quick questions, if I may. Number one, is there any ability for you to recoup any of these unauthorized payments that were made over the last couple of years?
It's Gwynn here. It's Gwynn here. You know, as we launched the investigation under the direction of the audit committee and with independent counsel and also international advisors that try to can do things like trace money and so on, and we haven't been able to get to the bottom of this as to where the money went, as reported in the independent report that you've seen released today. Obviously, if we can determine ways of recouping money on behalf of the shareholders, we'll do that.
Okay. And last question, has any of this, of these issues, has it started to influence your ability to win new business? Are any customers backing away because of the uncertainty around the company at this point?
No. In point of fact, if you look at the month of March, it was one of the strongest months we've had, and that, of course, is all post the release that we made at the end of February.
Fair enough. And on business you're bidding on now, I mean, those were contracts which were already well underway, and it would be probably difficult for customers to get out of contracts at that point. But, I mean, new stuff that you're bidding on that's getting into the pipeline, has that changed in any ability for you to get on, you know, people raising this as an issue?
No. We've got high-quality people. We've got a strong balance sheet to support our activities, and there's no indication that's going to be anything other than carrying on as we've done before.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Your next question comes from Pierre Lacroix with Desjardins Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. Just wanted to have some more perspective on the agency business. You're doing business with international agent, or is it more a practice that is done internationally, or you have that in Canada as well? So I would just like to get an overall perspective on how that business is working.
Well, I'll just give you a few. It's Gwyn here. I'll just give you a few little bit of background on the general nature of the industry as the agent issue as it relates to our industry. You know, in the global engineering and construction industry, retention of representatives or agents, as we come to know them, are common practice really around the world by virtually almost all of our competitors. SNC level and agent agreements do stipulate that the agent adheres to all applicable laws and that the agent has not committed any act which might cause SNC-Lavalin to be in violation of those laws. And, of course, under these two circumstances, these very special and unusual circumstances that we've been investigating, we were trying to determine whether that was or wasn't the case. And as the report said, we haven't been able to determine either way. The company is a founding member of the Partnering Against Corruption Initiative, constituted by member companies of the World Economic Forum in partnership with the Transparency International and the Basel Institute of Governance, which provides guiding principles for retaining representatives. The role of representatives may include relationship building or promoting the company's qualifications to clients, providing advice on bid preparation, negotiation, and can continue right through the entire project if we do win a project, for example, assisting in getting the necessary construction permits and carrying out the successful execution of the project, helping with the, you know, import-export issues around materials and labor to come into the country, and even assisting us sometimes in obtaining local labor, and finally assisting in the settlement of potential contract disputes and helping to expedite the timely payments. I might say that it's not the agency agreements or the idea of attaining agencies in and of itself that is so much of the problem. It's following those procedures and those values that I've just stipulated. And in the two cases, obviously, that broke down, and that's why we've done all of this thorough investigation to follow that up.
Okay, thanks for this this perspective. But if I follow up on this, you know, do you consider your network of agents to be a competitive advantage, or you know, do you think what is happening right now is impairing a little bit your ability to do business with some agents? So some perspective on that as well, please.
No, I mean, I think the fact is that, again, these are very specific issues, and you know, the company has a 100-year-old history, and we've never really been in this situation before, and we hope we'll never be again, and we're taking measures to prevent it ever happening again.
Okay. One final for Ian and Jill, maybe in terms of the relationship and the contact with your key customers, I guess. You know, in the last month or so, you know, it's been relatively on hold in talking to your clients. Do you have a plan to get back talking to them very shortly, and or you want to wait to have a new CEO in place before doing that?
You have to remember that we have people leading each of these business segments and divisions who are dealing with customers and clients all the time. And that network is in place and has continued to be in place.
Yeah, but my question was kind of more at the top management level. Do you intend to have a campaign of going out and have more an open discussion with clients about what's happening?
We're always transparent, and we will continue to be that way.
I just might add, you know, to what Ian's saying here, these division leaders and executive vice presidents and people in the office of the president are very senior people, and they all, each one of them run the different areas, you know, in different divisions, and they all have their own relationships with the clients that are top-level relationships, and only this morning I was speaking to some of them, and they were already planning this afternoon to start that process and with the support of the CEO. Obviously, he's got a few other things to do as well right now, but it is the key thing for the company to maintain the confidence of our clients. Ian's already mentioned that you know, the strength of the company financially, or Ian and Jill, and the important thing for clients is to know that we've got 28,000 people who are at their service, and we've had a very few people involved in the problems that have occurred recently.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Bert Powell with BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Gwen, in the press release, you talk about reporting matters to appropriate authorities or intend to. Have you done that, and can you talk to which authorities you contemplate having dialogue with?
Well, what we have done, in fact, I guess, are doing as we speak, almost, I believe, more or less. You know, anyway, I mean, we're in the process of doing that virtually now, and we're actually reporting to the authorities which have jurisdiction, and in this case, we'll deal through our Canadian authorities because that's where we're based, and they will take whatever action they may or may not take with regard to international matters.
So you're not engaging in any geographies beyond Canada at this point.
Really, I think that it's our own Canadian authorities that have the decisions to make in that regard.
Okay. And are these regulatory authorities, or are these in the likes of the RCMP?
Well, as it relates to things like, as I mentioned, the Libya matter, we're talking to, I think it'd be the RCMP, and other authorities that would be, would basically be police authorities that we're turning material over to.
Okay. And the catalyst for the investigation, or the independent investigation, was the $35 million in contracts, correct?
The catalyst for the investigation around the payments was that, yes, and that's correct.
So what? And you've made the statement in your remarks that you believe this is somewhat ring fenced to these two contracts. But I'm wondering if you can give us a sense as to you know, how broad a scope the investigation took to see if this wasn't just. You know, that this wasn't an isolated incident, that in fact, systemically, there are other areas in the company that needed to be examined.
Well, I know you probably haven't had a chance to read the independent report, but I think it covers a lot of that, actually. But just in short form, this has been a very thorough investigation of both our internal matters by internal auditors, by external auditors, the investigation itself. I believe that there's never been such a thorough review. I know there's been never a review of this nature in depth and thoroughness in the history of this company, and I would imagine almost every other one. So, you know, we have a lot of confidence in saying that these are isolated incidents.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Hamza Mazari with Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Most of my questions have been answered. I just have two quick ones. You know, maybe if you could add a little more color as to the CEO search process. You know, are you looking both external and internal? Are you looking for someone from outside the industry or inside? And what's your timing? How should investors think about that?
Well, this is an international search. It will include our executives, or people, or candidates, I should say, from inside the company as well. And we will be working to, of course, choose the best possible executive. Clearly, when we're looking for executives, or when you're looking to replace a CEO in this complicated business and competitive business, you would like to have people who have experience, very directly related experience. And, you know, that's about all I can say. In terms of the timing of it, I would say that the... You know, we're moving, as I said in the my early remarks, we're going to move forward expeditiously, and there's no reason why this has to drag on. And it's my top priority as chairman, and the committee that we talked about earlier, the transition committee, will be helping me and being part of that process.
That's fair enough. Thank you. And then just a question on your appetite and ability. To do further acquisitions. You know, you had a big acquisition here last year. Does the internal control weakness for you guys limit or delay further acquisitions? You know, do you need to fix your internal issues before you start getting aggressive on the acquisition front again?
I'll take that one. I mean, to the extent that, as Gwen has said, these are isolated events, and we've done comprehensive due diligence on all our acquisitions, and to the extent we continue to grow the company, there's no reason that the focus on acquisitions would be any different from what it's been.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Frederic Bastien with Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Good morning. These undocumented payments point to projects that were under the influence of the EVP of construction who's departed. Over which jurisdiction did this person have direct oversight?
Well, the construction division of the company is a very large division because, of course, it gets involved in virtually all of our construction projects, so they can be virtually across the world. So we may do, for example, we do engineering work, and many times what we build is what we have designed, the engineers have designed. But the construction group will step in and help any one of the divisions, for example, mining and metallurgy or hydrocarbon and chemicals or infrastructure or so on, will really be a part of the SNC team in many, many areas that we're actually doing the construction in. So it's a pretty broad, they operate broadly across the company and around the world.
But based on your earlier comments, Gwen, is it correct to conclude given who you're hiring is to do some, well, I don't know if you're hiring them, but the investigations are being currently conducted. Is it correct to conclude that the projects being investigated are not in Canada?
Well, again, we just aren't going to comment on where the projects are. We won't do that at any time. But it's fair to say that the only thing we have said is that they were carried out within the construction division under the jurisdiction of a person who's no longer here.
All right. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Gareth Tingling with Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. I have a couple of questions for Gilles and then Gwen, if you don't mind, a couple for you. Gilles, I was just wondering first if you could talk about the revenue mix between packages, services, and O&M for 2012 compared to 2011. Do you expect the mix to be the same or similar?
Again, you're asking me a tough question as we provided very limited amount of guidance and we were, you know, we concluded on that. But certainly you could draw certain conclusion based on our year-end backlog on services and on packages. And it's quite easy to draw when you compare our backlog of services as at year-end 2010 of $1.4 billion compared to year-end December 2011 at $2.2 billion. And while packages are about the same, if I could say, so then I would lead you to your own conclusion on that, if you permit me.
Thank you, Gilles, for that direction. Let me redirect a little bit then and ask you this as a follow-up. Contract durations across your three lines of generic buckets for how you look at your business, are the durations changing? Are they lengthening or are they about the same?
For sure, on the services side, we've been obtaining some large projects that are a bit, I would say, longer duration, but overall, as a whole, I would say not really. And I would say the same thing for packages. I don't think the lengthening would be. For sure, the fact that, and I think Ian addressed that, for example, in the business of nuclear, whereby there will be some various phases. However, what we booked is the first phase of the Darlington project. It could be continuation of project. And likewise, on the service side, in the potash business, again, it could be, and we're going in a prudent fashion in booking those backlog. But in general, I would not say that the nature of the duration or the duration of services, packages, or O&M has recently changed.
Okay. My next question is, there's very little discussion about anticipated charges or provisions for the independent investigation, severance to the CEO, possible fines, penalties, or even the costs associated with the creation of a new global reporting and monitoring system. I was wondering when you anticipate that we'll be able to get some sort of an indication as to management's assessment of potential impact.
I would say we certainly took into account an estimation for the cost on the investigation side, and you know the extra word that was carried with regards to any liability that could arose to the company following those projects, for example, and likewise, for example, in Bangladesh. At this stage, there's no way we can assess that, and so there's no amount being taken into account into that.
I see. Well, if you wouldn't mind, then I haven't come across the estimation for the changes that you just referred to. Forget about Bangladesh, but your former statement with respect to the cost for the investigation, etc. What's the total amount that you're looking at for that?
At this present moment, I would not want to disclose of that. I'm sorry, but
that's okay. I wasn't certain if it had been disclosed within the MD&A, but
no,
I was unaware of it.
No, unfortunately, it was not. Sorry.
Okay. And will these disclosure when these amounts become known, they will be made separate from the operations of the companies, or are we going to be looking at charges against the divisions where work was perceived to be needed, or where where more work is required? Are we going to see this as a completely separate charges, or are they going to be rolled into existing costs in some cases?
We, as our, I would say, our practices is to be transparent, and as you can see, the practice we've been using in publishing the full report of the independent review, and as well, many of our MD&A disclosure, we will certainly disclose the cost of those investigation and our reporting in the upcoming quarters.
The only thing I would add to Gilles' answer is that, you know, I don't think the costs of examining our own internal procedures and so on and making them even better than they have been and trying to make sure, as I said earlier, that this sort of thing never happens again are not going to be material in terms of the actual cost to shareholders. I mean, this is an internal process that Jill will be leading along with our interim CEO and the rest of the team. But the costs of the investigation and all of that are a separate matter, and as Jill said, they will be reported and already partly included in our results.
Okay, and the guidance that you're providing for 2012 is exclusive of any of these kinds of charges or other kinds of costs. Is that correct?
As I mentioned, the investigation or the independent review that was done and the additional work from an audit standpoint, these were taken into account in terms of the estimate of the guidance we've been providing.
Yeah, I should have said our guidance rather than results, because obviously these are 2012 expenses.
Sure. Okay, and Gwynne, my question is, first of all, when is the AGM for the company?
I think it's May the 3rd.
Okay.
In Toronto, by the way.
Wonderful. I was wondering, are there any anticipated changes to the composition of the board for this year's AGM that were previously known, i.e. people planning to step down or any kinds of changes that that were anticipated?
There was one anticipated before, only one. It came up before any of this came up. Our Senator Hugh Siegel has been appointed by the Prime Minister to be his—I don't know exactly what it's called—but in effect, it's de facto ambassador to the whole Commonwealth, which is what 50 countries or something. And under the circumstances, he had approached me some time ago and said, "You know, under this process, I just can't be—I'm not going to be able to attend the meetings, and I shouldn't really be on the board." So, other than that, we expect the full slate to be on the circular for the re-election.
Okay, and my last question is, are there any coincident departures that weren't press released with this news that's come out today?
No.
Okay, that's it for me. Thank you, gentlemen.
Your next question comes from Michael Tupholme with TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks, sir. Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to clarify on the guidance. When you say flat year-over-year, not taking into account any adjustments for 2011, are you?
We are not. We're taking the amount of net income attributable to SNC-Lavalin shareholders of $279 million.
Okay. And then the second question, can you talk a little bit about the timeline and the process for implementing the improvements in the internal controls that the board has recommended?
Maybe I'll take that, Ian. I'll take that. I mean, we have already embarked on some work, of course, and it'll be done again expeditiously. We're in the process of making sure that the practices and procedures that we adopt are the best, and so while we want to get it done quickly, we don't want to redo it three or four times. So we're trying to strike that balance, and we will make it a big priority within the organization to do it, as they say, as expeditiously as we can and as thoroughly as you would expect.
Follow on that, should we expect to hear about some developments or as that progresses, or will this simply be a situation where it'll happen over time and that'll be all?
I'm not sure how much of our internal processes are something that need a lot of publicity. I mean, to the extent that as a management team, you know, we will be reporting to the audit committee and the board. You know, to the extent those things are germane in a disclosure sense of internal controls and so forth, you know, they would come out in the normal course. Otherwise, we will put in the practices and procedures that we feel are appropriate. And, you know, unless there was something particularly noteworthy, I don't think we would talk about it separately.
The only thing I'd add to what Ian just said is that, you know, the audit committee, which Ian is a member of, or at least was till today, I guess.
Okay.
it has already, at the direction of the board, undertaking a major review of our agent review processes and agent retention processes, so that has already been implemented. We didn't think there was any time to lose in that regard.
And sorry, just one other follow-up on this same point. When you look at your peers in the industry, are there any major differences right now in terms of the way your controls were structured relative to your peer group or not?
I would say we pride ourselves to have had over the past in terms of reporting practice or I would say controls on our operation, a very thorough review. That being said, certainly, as we've pointed out in our MD&A, the material weakness refers to, in particular, the agent policy and the code of ethics. So this is something that we are committed, and we don't want to reflect in the future again that we have a material weakness that deals with those two considerations. So I would say that compared to competitors, difficult to assess with regards to their dealing with agents' policy, but like any other of our competitor, for sure the code of ethics is a very important point to them, as it is to us, and as we are tackling it in a very serious fashion right now.
Okay, thank you.
Good.
Mr. Jasmine, we have no further questions at this time. Please continue.
Thank you to all analysts and investors to have joined us today. Gilles and myself will now leave the room, and I will now turn the conference call over to Leslie Quinton, Vice President, Global Corporate Communication, who will continue with the question period with the journalist.
Thank you, Denis. Our Chairman, Gwynne Morgan, and our Interim CEO, Ian Bourne, have agreed to accept a few questions from journalists. You may ask your questions in English or French. If in French, I can translate or summarize them in order to be answered. Notre président du conseil, Gwynne Morgan, et notre chef de la direction par intérim, Ian Bourne, sont disponibles pour répondre à quelques questions des journalistes. Vous pouvez poser vos questions en anglais ou en français. Pour les questions en français, je vais traduire ou résumer en anglais pour qu'elles puissent être répondues. You may go ahead. Je vous invite à poser vos questions.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, you may press the star followed by the one on your touchtone phone. Next question on the line comes from Dave Seglund with CBC. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I have a question, two questions, and it relates to you've mentioned that virtually you have contacted authorities. Can you confirm yet, have you notified the RCMP about the findings of this internal probe?
Well, what we're saying is that, the situations are different, of course, depending on the particular jurisdiction. And so we are, I believe that the current status is that the authorities have been contacted, the authorities having jurisdiction have been contacted, and in due course our legal representatives will be meeting with them and passing on whatever we have.
Okay, could you be specific which agencies?
No. We'll be dealing with the agencies having particular jurisdiction depending on situation.
Okay. On Thursday last, the RCMP arrived in Mexico, and they were there to interrogate a consultant, Ms. Cindy Vanier, and they were asking her, they told her that she was only a witness, but asking her about dealings with SNC-Lavalin, Stéphane Roy, Riyad Benessa. Now, she was a consultant. She's there in a Mexican prison, but she was drawn into work in Libya, hired by SNC-Lavalin, Mr. Roy, Mr. Benessa. Her work, as she describes it, was to travel to Libya. She was doing some fact-finding for your company. By her own signed contracts, she was going to advise on the reintegration of employees after the war. What obligation do you have to her, and what has SNC-Lavalin done to investigate its role in her plight as she sits there in a prison accused in this bizarre plot to try to smuggle Gaddafi's to Mexico?
Well, we have no obligation to Madame Vanier. The fact is that she was hired, apparently, even without the knowledge of anyone else in the company except for the persons that have left the company and from the construction division. And we weren't able to get any more information from them because they weren't willing to provide it, and they're no longer with the company. So, we only now, as it matters related to Madame Vanier and that whole affair, are following what is reported, as I said earlier, in the media. We did, prior to the departure of Stéphane Roy and Vanessa,
have our counsel do the company's counsel review everything we could find out, and that is what is being turned over to the authorities.
That particular information will be turned over now?
Yes.
And has not been to date?
No, you know, there's been no contact. They never made any contact with us. The authorities never contacted us all regarding this, but we believe that, you know, given that we don't have any conclusive information either way about this, but we felt that we should at least give them what we have and offer to provide anything we have, and that's all we can do.
Mr. Rawal reported to you, and Ms. Vanier also contends that she had arranged a meeting to discuss water projects in Mexico. And I guess as a question I'd ask, in your review, did you find evidence to support the fact that there was legitimate business being done, meetings being set up between SNC-Lavalin through Ms. Vanier with authorities in Mexico to discuss water projects?
We really don't have any further details that we can pass on about this because, as I said, these things were done by people that aren't here, and so we can't determine it exactly what happened and what was said.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Paul Waldy with the Globe and Mail. Please go ahead.
Yeah, the report mentions, I've got a couple of questions, but the report mentions that back in 2010 and in 2011, I presume it's Mr. Laramie because it says the CFO was told about some of these payments, didn't like them, but somehow they seem to have been carried on. I'm just wondering if you can tell me how far back this went. It talks about 2009, him having some knowledge in 2010 and 2011. Can you fill in some of those blanks?
Well, what really occurred here was that the actual, just to put this sort of straightly as I can, for the 2010 matter, the matter that was paid in 2010, again, it was done within the construction division, and there wasn't any knowledge on the part of the CFO or pretty much anyone else at top management at that time when those are entered into and paid. When it became evident to the CFO that they were paid, of course we already knew the money had gone out because it was accounted for. It was accounted for under a contract that was out misallocated. So the CFO became aware of that and told the CEO, and that was his role in doing so.
But that would have been in 2010 at least, right?
Yes.
Can you also tell me how all of this came to light? It mentions in there in December 2011 the company received information. Was this a whistleblower internal? Can you give us some detail on how this all came to light?
There were a number of things here. I'm actually going to ask Jill to answer this because there was a process, an internal process. Internal auditors were involved in this. Just to have Jill answer this because this doesn't break down in terms of what I should say is that, you know, we had this thorough investigation. And the report is very extensive that we issued today. And all of those things are articulated. So I guess maybe I just best to refer you to that because otherwise we might get into something that really has already been said and thoroughly analyzed and well thought out as to how it's been articulated.
One last question then. Why isn't the CFO leaving if he knew about this in 2010?
Well, the CFO did his job. He passed it on to the CEO. And at the time when the statements were issued for 2010, the fact that we don't actually report by project, we report by division, this misallocation issue was not material to the financial results. However, he did pass on the fact that it had been misallocated to the CEO, and he did his job. And we have complete and absolute confidence in our CFO.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next next question comes from Philippe Saulnier with Radio Canada. Please go ahead.
Oui, bonjour. Donc, c'est possible de répondre en français, s'il vous plaît. Qu'allez-vous faire maintenant? Quelles recommandations allez-vous mettre en place là, dans ce qui a été, dans ce qui est sorti du rapport?
Philippe, juste pour comprendre, ils ne peuvent pas répondre en français, mais je vais résumer la question en anglais afin qu'ils puissent répondre.
Il n'y a pas personne qui peut parler en français, là. Il n'y a pas personne qui peut nous répondre en français, c'est ça?
Mais les porte-paroles pour cet appel sont bien notre président et notre et M. Bourne et M. Morgan. Ils sont les deux porte-paroles pour le moment.
Ah, OK.
Est-ce que ça pose un problème?
Je vais quand même y aller avec ma question. Allez-y, oui, allez-y.
So, Philippe would like to know, what are the recommendations following this investigation?
Well, in the MD&A, these are set out. They include adoption of clear corporate policies regarding procedures to be followed in the cases of management departures and management requests or directs others to disregard the company's policies and procedures, clear duties to report violations or proposed violations to the policies and procedures, including the code of ethics. And we recommend that the board of directors has approved the following: the creation of an agent review committee to review and approve the and entering into any of the agency agreements, annual review of the agent's policy by the governance committee of the board, annual confirmation of compliance with the agent's policy by the executive VP, enhanced due diligence procedures in connection with agency agreements, and formal training of the company's commercial agents on the code of ethics of the company. So these are all changes that we believe are going to further strengthen and help prevent what has occurred ever happening again.
Comment expliquer que la compagnie s'est retrouvée avec une telle situation, dans une telle situation? C'est quand même bizarre. Comment expliquer ça? Comment ils expliquent ça?
How did the company find itself in such a situation? Is this not a little odd? How would you explain it?
Well, as has been said earlier, this is a very unique set of circumstances. This division is a very large, the construction division is a very large division doing billions of dollars of business around the world. And unfortunately, as this chief financial officer said earlier, we had a breakdown in our controls in this matter, in the sense that it was possible for these kinds of monies to be, these contracts to be entered into and the money to be paid without proper corporate approval. And that is how we got into the situation, mm-hmm. and the things we're changing to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Et une dernière courte question. Est-ce qu'il estime que ça ternit l'image de l'entreprise à l'étranger, mais également est-ce que ça a engendré des pertes de contrats? Est-ce que cette histoire-là, ça fait en sorte que des pays qui ont reculé les entreprises, est-ce que ça a amené des pertes de contrats?
Do you feel this has tarnished the image of the company and that we have lost perhaps contracts based upon this news?
There's no evidence that we've lost contracts based on this news. As I said in the investor portion of the call, we continue to, and we saw in the month of March, very strong receipt of orders, and we continue to pursue business in our various divisions with quality engineering and construction people that we've got. So we feel this is going to be something that we'll move forward quickly and well.
Mm-hmm. Mais c'est quoi l'impact sur la compagnie de ce genre d'événement-là? Vous le mesurez comment?
What kind of impact would this have on the company? How would you summarize it?
Well, first of all, I put it this way. This is a company which has, as the CFO pointed out earlier, some $1.2 billion in cash. Mm-hmm. We do hundreds of millions and billions of dollars business around the world. We've had problems with $50 million of unauthorized and improperly paid payments. We're going to put this behind us. We're going to prevent it from ever happening again. But in terms of the overall stability and structure of the company, I might say that we have 28,000 people around the world who are ethical, dedicated, and capable, and less than a handful involved in creating what has occurred.
Merci beaucoup.
Your next question comes from Jeremy Lemmer with the Financial Times. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks very much for taking my question. Two points that I was hoping to get your response to. The first is you talked about the fact you're very confident in the internal investigation you've conducted, and yet you haven't been able to speak to some of the key people involved and the third parties involved have also, in your review you mentioned, been reluctant to get back to you. So I'm wondering about the confidence you have in this review. To my mind, it seems preliminary at best. And the second point is it seems to strain credulity that none of your customers have responded to you or asked for reassurances or been concerned by this whole process. So I was hoping you could comment on that. What have your customers been saying to you? What type of questions have they been asking you?
Well, first of all, the investigation was anything but cursory. The review is very, very thorough, and it as I mentioned earlier, could not possibly have been more thorough in every aspect. And what happens with these sorts of things is you find out what you find out, and there are things that you can't find out, and that is the conclusion, and it's clearly there. The whole idea when the board asked that the audit committee commission these investigations was to do everything possible to get to the bottom of things, and the investigative report that has been issued today certainly is very clear in all the things that were done and how thorough it was.
And I would reiterate, as I did in my comments, earlier, we've received a number of orders recently, including the 407 transaction last week, the Darlington transaction a couple of weeks before that, the project down in Venezuela. And we're certainly not going to, elaborate on communications we've had with customers, but suffice it to say that the orders continue to flow and the relationships with the customers continue to be strong.
Great, thank you.
Next question comes from Sylvain Larocque with Canadian Press. Please go ahead.
Oui, bonjour. Donc, je veux savoir, en fait, comment M. Duhaime avait pu autoriser ces paiements-là malgré l'opposition du CFO et du président du conseil d'administration?
How was Pierre Duhaime able to authorize these payments despite the opinion against it by the CFO?
Well,
and the board was president of the board as well.
Sorry, the board was not aware of the payments, of course, and obviously.
Yeah, Ian, I think there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding. The reference in the report to the chairman was the chairman of SLI International, not the chairman of the corporate board.
Okay.
Thank you for clarifying that.
So how could Mr. Jam authorize those while the CFO would not authorize that?
Well, in a corporate hierarchy, the CEO is the number one authority in the company. So I guess if the CEO authorizes something, it means that it gets done. However, having said that, in fact, the proper procedure that the CEO should have followed was to take it to the board.
OK. Maintenant, je veux savoir, est-ce que c'est courant que SNC-Lavalin fait des paiements comme ça à des agents commerciaux?
Is it true that SNC-Lavalin makes these kind of payments to commercial agents?
Oh, is it often that you do that kind of payment?
Well, souvent. Do we often do it?
Well, as I said earlier in the meeting, these commercial agents are used by all of virtually all engineering companies are almost all around the world, and certainly almost every one of our competitors. It's not a question of whether commercial agents are the right or wrong thing to do, because they're a reality in many cases in terms of what is needed to execute projects. The issue here is with these two particular ones. There was many things about these projects. These were different. First of all, I might say, was their size. These were very large payments compared to the average of what we pay. I think I was looking at some numbers recently, and if we look at our average, sort of three-year average payments to agents, it would more likely be in the $700,000 range. And so the scale of these is also very large.
charge. And so there are so many things different about them. The authorization process wasn't followed. The investigation of the details about the qualifications of the agents and all of the various things and the approval process internally were, and their size that made them distinguished. These are two very special things, and you know, in the history of the company, we haven't seen this before.
Mm-hmm. And I guess sometimes the line between payments to agents like that and bribes is a little bit thin, is it?
Well, as I said earlier, both our code of ethics and our membership in the international organization that tries to prevent bribery is things we count on and certainly strive to prevent.
Okay, I have a last question about Libya. I know it might not be directly related to the inquiry, but how come SNC-Lavalin insisted so much on staying in Libya when it was it's the opposition now that's in power and you were very close to the former regime? So I don't understand why the company wants so much to stay in Libya when it's the opposition now that's in power.
Well, you know, the fact, just remember that that in Libya, for, what is it, 3 decades or more, the Gaddafi regime was in place. There was hundreds of companies operating there. We had prime ministers and presidents around the world going to visit Gaddafi in the later years and so on before all of this happened. So, you know, this was a country that many people were operating in, and we were one of those companies. We did some excellent work in there. One of the biggest projects is that we had to evacuate people from was the great man-made river project to take water to what is a large portion of a very parched part of the country. It would have dramatically changed the way of life in that country. Unfortunately, that project has been suspended, and what was referred to earlier by our CFO is that we obviously would... under the right circumstances and the right assurances for shareholders and security, recommence the project. The Prime Minister has been to the country and has said that, you know, Canada would help rebuild to the extent possible. So we're going to be looking at restarting at some point, but it's going to have to be under the kind of assurances that the projects can be secure, that the money will be paid, and that everything will be in the proper done in the proper manner.
And you don't think that the government now, the new government, wouldn't want to do it with another company that has not had links with the former regime?
Well, every other company that's operated in the country, including all other engineering companies, had links with the regime, or they couldn't have done any business.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Nick Van Pratt with National Post. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Can you just tell me why there seems to be quite a spectacular failure of Mr. Duhem to act in his proper role as CEO here? Why are you not taking any action against him?
You know, we've already said what has happened here. I also said that we thanked our CEO for his 23 years of service. He did some tremendous things over his period. He made some errors in the recent days and recent times. We have no reason to believe that he overtly wanted to breach the code of ethics or doing anything else that was wrong. But in fact, you know, the CEO, the report reports on what happened. And, you know, I've been a CEO, and I knew all along that things that happened under my watch would ultimately be my accountability, and that's no different than the case with Pierre.
But if there's one person that should know what your agent's policy is and the ins and outs of that, it should be your CEO. How do you explain just the fact that there was just such a big breach of failure here in terms of acting properly?
Well, again, you know, I have to let the independent report stand for itself. I'd only add that that once again remind that all of the actual contracts that we're talking about, these two major problem contracts or problem payments, were conducted within a division that obviously had hidden the nature of those payments and the allocation of them to the wrong contract. That was not something that our CEO was directly
involved in, but his oversight obviously was insufficient, and some of his action taken subsequent to that was not proper. So that's been clearly put forward in the report, and you know, it stands for itself.
But there's no legal action being taken against Mr. Duran by the company?
No, certainly not.
Okay, and what is, maybe you could just describe the relationship you have right now with Mr. Benanisa and Mr. Roy. Is there, do you have any contact with them? And or,
well, as far as we know, Mr. Benanisa is not in the country. His home, I think he lives in Tunisia, but I wouldn't know where he is. But obviously, at the time when they were when they left the company, we've had no further contact.
And are you seeking in any way to, I mean, is there any legal action between SNC and those two individuals at this point?
Well, you know, again, I refer to the independent investigation, and we did our best to find out everything we could about the course of the ultimate course of those payments, and have been able to do so. So at this point, there's been no further action we can take.
Okay, and Mr. Benanisa indicated at one point that he was going to potentially sue the company for breach of reputation or something. Has he done that?
We have not seen any sign of that.
Okay, thanks very much.
Your next question comes from Sophie Cousineau avec La Presse. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Morgan. I have a question. How, if you don't know where the payments went, how can you be so sure it has nothing to do with Libya?
Well, again, I'll refer to the independent report, and all of the information we've been able to gather, that our investigation was able to gather, is points to the understanding and the confidence the board has it's highly unlikely it they found their way to Libya.
Okay, but how can we be so convinced that there's nothing in this report to that effect? And Mr. Issa was, you know, your Libya point man.
Well, all I can say is that the board, after looking at everything, has concluded that we have no reason to believe whatever that is that the money went to Libya.
Okay. And concerning the one of the first questions that was asked to you in this conference was regarding the authorities. But I'm pretty sure I understood that in the analyst call you said that you specified that there was information given to the RCMP in regards to Libya. Can you clarify what has been given to the RCMP and to on which issue specifically?
No, what I was talking about was separating the payments, which we believe are a completely separate matter than Libya. But with regard to the whole what people call Vanier affair, we had two people in the company who are no longer here who were involved in that, and no one else knew about it really. At least the management didn't, and neither did the board. So to the extent that company counsel look into everything we could find out. And, you know, the fact is that there wasn't very much that we could gather because we didn't have we weren't able to determine very much from people who were now no longer with the company.
Okay. So concerning these payments, nothing was given to the RCMP regarding these payments?
Well, the payments are a different matter. You were asking about Libya, and I was asking about Libya.
Yes,
so
but
that,
my question is, has any document pertaining to these, misallocated payments been forwarded to the RCMP?
Well, as I said earlier, the company is in the process of contacting and will be passing on any information we have with regard to the payments and basically the inconclusive results of our investigation to the relevant authorities, and we'll be in the process of doing that very soon.
Okay, and is this the RCMP in this case?
As I said earlier, all I can say is it would be to the authorities have to work with in the situation.
Okay, and I have just a follow-up. If these agency contracts were so different than what he normally pay and they stood out so much, wasn't this something that Mr. Demem would have known especially since he overrided his, you know, the head of the SNCN International to authorize these payments?
Well, as I said earlier, all that is clearly set out in the report as to when he knew what and what his actions were, and we just don't want to, we're not going to comment on it further. You can certainly have access to the release that was made today.
Mm-hmm. No, I've read it, but I'm just wondering why, in your view, how do you explain that as your seasoned CEO? You've been on board of many companies. I mean, this was something that's highly irregular, is it not?
Well, I think both the report and the actions that we've taken speak for themselves.
Okay. So did you ask Mr. Duham to resign?
Mr. Duham retired from the company and stepped down as CEO and chief executive, and so those are that's the facts, and that's what is happening.
Your next question comes from Ian Austin with New York Times. Please go ahead.
Hi. You mentioned that you have 28,000 honest employees and tried to portray this as a few bad apples. But, you know, here we're looking at a serious misjudgment by the chief executive officer, the head of your largest operating unit, and a senior financial person within it. Does this not raise serious questions about the whole management structure of the company as well as the director's oversight of the company?
Well, you know, obviously, there's a lot of questions that could be raised. That's why the board authorized this independent investigation. These are serious matters. We're taking them seriously. And, you know, the board acted as soon as it was aware of them. That really was very close to the February 28th press release we made. At that point, we couldn't say any more because we didn't know much more. And now we have the report out there. Clearly, a board of directors can't govern something that they don't know about or prevent something they're not aware of. But what we can do, and that is what we are doing, is to examine all of our procedures so that the board can be confident that these kinds of events will not happen again.
And in terms of future business, as you know, the company's ties with the Gaddafi family have become a political issue. Is that going to affect your participation in the Abraham Lincoln National Airport project in Illinois?
Well, you know, there are many kinds of moving parts in that situation. One of the key parts of that is that there was already strong opposition from some local groups opposing a, quote, foreign contractor that we're here up here in north of the border. And so they were actively opposing our participation and selection well before all of this came out. Of course, now that it has, it would be quite expected they would be using that as some further part of the argument. But this is a local battle, and it has a lot to do with their own form of protectionism, if I could put it that way.
Your next question comes from Ross Malowitz with the Canadian Press. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering, first of all, do you use agents in Canada?
Well, again, here the matter of agents, where we use them, when we use them, is a matter of confidentiality, and we don't comment on that. We really operate in a global business where our competitors are global, and that is the nature of our business.
So these payments could have been for contracts within Canada.
We're just not commenting on any matter of where contracts are, where particular agent contracts are, and what they're for.
Why would that be? I mean, there's all kinds of investigations about corruption in Quebec. Why wouldn't you just clearly state that it is or is not in Canada?
Well, again, it's something that, you know, when whatever we do, if we start, as I said earlier, if we start commenting on locations of contracts anytime,
we violate our fundamental rule, and we're not going to do it in this case either.
Do you know what the payments were used for?
The report makes clear that we weren't able to fully determine that, and I commented in my opening remarks the same thing.
So then how could you not? How could you be sure that they weren't used for bribes or other uses?
Well, again, the investigative report was unable to conclude either way, and that's what we've made clear. When the board authorized these investigations, what we really wanted to do on behalf of shareholders and for all kinds of other reasons, the reputation of the company and so on, was to see if we could get to the bottom of where this, how this money was used. We've done everything possible to do that, and the report concludes that we weren't able to really determine the use of those payments.
And how much did Mr. Duhem cooperate in this investigation?
Completely.
And so was he not aware of what the payments were used for?
In terms of the course of what actually ended up happening to the money?
Yes.
He wasn't. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had to do all this investigation. The people who ultimately know, I guess, are the people who left the company, and they're not giving us that information.
So he basically signed several millions of dollars without knowing what the money was used for?
Well, again, I'm just going to refer you to the report. You know, answering one question in isolation from what the background is a hard, is sort of a misleading thing to do. There was more to it than that, I just refer you to the report.
Okay, and finally, are you concerned at all that this is that the public will perceive that this is how the industry operates, and it'll put a black eye on the entire construction industry?
Well, obviously it's not good news in terms of that sense, but what we keep on saying and what are the facts are is that we've operated in this case 100 years and we haven't had this kind of a problem. We've been retained lots of agents and done thousands and thousands of projects around the world. So, I think that we all have to put this into perspective.
Thanks very much.
We have time for one last question. Your last question comes from François Pouliot with Les Affaires. Please go ahead.
Hello, sir. I found the last question was very interesting. Mr. Duhem, he knew there was a problem with the $33 million contract, and it's hard to believe that he decided to authorize the payment without asking many questions about this contract. I would like to know more about that.
Well, I keep having to refer to the report because it was such a thorough investigation. It talks about specifically what the president knew and what he did through this whole process. It's a very complicated matter. And
was it in the press release? Because I read the press release and there were no reference about what he knew and what he didn't know.
Which press release did you read?
The press release you released this morning.
Well, we issued two press releases. That one was issued relating to the independent investigation, and this is the one that has...
Yeah, I read this one, but there's no reference about what Mr. Duhem knew.
Well, there's a lot in there.
The press release says that he signed, he approved the payment.
Yeah.
But we don't know the question he asked and why he approved it.
Yeah. What was facing our CEO, and this is not any defense of his actions, but what was facing him was a contract that was entered into by an agent from people who were in senior officer position of the company, and for various reasons he felt he was obligated to pay the bill. In hindsight, we all regret that.
Who was this senior?
Well, we just finished talking about that. The head of our construction division, who's no longer with the company.
Yeah, but he knew that the CFO has refused to approve it.
Yes, all of that is contained in the report, and I just have no further comment on it.
That's okay, sir. Just one last question. It's sure that you will leave with a severance package?
Yeah, and again, we don't talk about the terms of departures of any executive or any other person in the company. Those are confidential, and in fact, specifically prohibited by the
but you, terms. But you will have to report it to the shareholders.
As I say, we'll do whatever we have to do in terms of regulatory filings, and of course, we'll follow all of the proper procedures.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. That's the end of our question period. Nos remerciements. Nous sommes terminés pour la journée.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference call for today. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your lines.